Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with a biographer about his or her work. This time, historian and author Pamela Toler talks about her latest book, The Dragon from Chicago, The Untold Story of an American Reporter in Nazi Germany. Published by Beacon Press in August of this year, this biography explores the life of Sigrid Schultz, the woman who headed the Chicago Tribune's bureau in Berlin from 1925 to 1941. I sat down with Pamela Toler via Zoom and asked her how she found and decided to write about this dynamic journalist.
I stumbled across her entirely by accident. One morning, this little news item showed up in my inbox. An architectural salvage vendor had found 75 glass plate photographic negatives in the attic of an old house in a North Side neighborhood in Chicago. And they were kind of unusual. That was a type of plate that would normally have been used for formal studio portraits at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. But these were informal pictures, and most of them were of a woman, a small girl, and a really large dog in and around the house where he found the plates. So he set out to find out something about them. And it turned out that the little girl was named Sigrid Schultz, and the woman was her mother, Hedwig, and the pictures were taken by her father, who was a Norwegian portrait painter who had immigrated to the United States in 1892. And that was all very interesting, and it was a nice way to procrastinate before I got into my workday. And then I hit the punchline, which was that she grew up to be a groundbreaking journalist for the Chicago Tribune, and that she was the Berlin bureau chief for the Chicago Tribune at a time when women just didn't hold those jobs. So, I mean, I was hooked. And it didn't take very long to really figure out how astonishing she was. There were just enough trails out there. You know, she showed up in one paragraph biographies of 20th century journalists and that kind of thing. So you got hints of just how astonishing she was. And I mean, I was interested enough that I actually stopped a different book proposal I was writing on. It just seemed like it was time to tell her story.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. So for people who don't know, and I didn't know, who is Sigrid Schultz?
Sigrid Schultz was an American reporter born in Chicago, and she was one of the first women to be a bureau chief. She was the Berlin bureau chief for the Chicago Tribune from 1925 to 1941. So she's there reporting on the rise of the Nazis.
That's amazing.
And, you know, all the other bureau chiefs, Colonel McCormick, who was the owner of the Chicago Tribune, he moved them around all the time. She stayed put. She was one of the anchor points of the Tribune in Europe at the time. It was also because she had roots in Berlin. By accident, she had gotten trapped there as a young woman during the First World War. And so she had contacts. She had just this extraordinary array of contacts that no other journalist could match in Berlin. And she also had extraordinary language skills. So she was fluent in German and French and Norwegian, and she could speak Italian. And she could fake her way through several other languages. And that was a range of language skills that most American journalists in Europe didn't have.
Exactly. So let's get into a little bit of her background. How did she come to be so multilingual?
Her father was Norwegian. Her mother was what she always described as a cosmopolitan background, which is kind of an interesting tag word. But basically, her mother was legally born in Germany, but her family was German, Spanish, Polish, Russian, French. So at that side of the family, a lot of different ethnicities involved. She was born in Chicago, and her parents were determined that she was going to grow up as a multilingual child. So The rule in the house was that she had to answer an adult in whatever language they spoke to her in. So she's got this grounding. And then when she was 8, her father took the family back to Europe because he got a really serious commission.
Now, when was she born?
1893.
Okay, gotcha. Right.
So 8 years old, she's headed back to Europe right at the beginning of the 20th century. They're only supposed to be there for 2 years, but he gets one commission after another. Her parents get sick. They don't come back. She spends time in schools in Germany, which she hated. And then they moved to Paris, which she loved. And she went to a really serious girls' academy in Paris. So she's growing up multilingual. She goes to Norway during the summers to visit her father's family. So she gets fluent in Norwegian. She studies Italian at school. She's the right place at the right time and is evidently good at languages too, because just because you're exposed to them all doesn't mean that you end up fluent in them all.
Exactly. Well, here's an interesting point. So we're talking about a woman who grows up in the early 20th century, where journalism was not a career path that most women either knew that they could ascend to or wanted to. So how does she go down this path? Into getting into journalism and then becoming such a revered professional.
Yeah, she basically stumbles into it. She's in Berlin. The First World War is ending, and American newspapers are starting to set up news bureaus in foreign cities. Berlin, obviously, is one of the important ones. And American reporters have begun to move into Berlin. And one night there was a party. It was the first big social event after the end of First World War in Berlin. It was a carnival costume ball. And Sigrid was invited, and she didn't know it, but she was invited as bait because the host of the party, who was an important banker and was the older brother of one of the students that she tutored as a way of earning money during the war, he and his fellow German businessmen really wanted to meet American reporters and have a chance to talk to them. So he sent his little brother around to the hotels where American reporters were and invited them to the party and said, if you come, there's going to be a young American woman there who can give you a firsthand account of what it was like to be in Berlin during the war. Two Chicago reporters were the only ones who accepted the invitation. One was Dick Little, who was the first Berlin bureau chief for the Chicago Tribune. So they come hoping to get this story. She comes because she wants to dance and have wonderful food and forget that it's cold and it's been a horrible few years. And she also learns there are going to be some other Americans there, and she's excited about that too. So she gets there, and she's wearing this beautiful blue gown in the style of Napoleonic France, and she's got her hair all up in this pompadour, and she meets these Americans. And before they have a chance to say anything, they're surrounded by a bunch of German guests who want to talk to the two reporters. But there's a language problem because neither Dick Little nor Ben Hecht, who's the other one, speak German. And even the Germans who do speak English don't speak it well enough so the Americans can understand them. And once Sigrid realized what the issue was, she basically said, "No problem, I'll translate." So instead of dancing, she spent hours doing this trilingual translation between English, German, and French about economics and history and politics, and being afraid that the Russians were going to invade from the east, and about the beginnings of the Weimar Constitution. And she absolutely loved it. And a few days later, after Dick Little gave her an informal test on translating an editorial from a German paper, she passed it with flying colors, and he immediately offered her a job as translator and Girl Friday and Cub reporter.
That's excellent. She was actually a great cub reporter. She learned a lot. So much so that eventually, and this obviously is how her career takes off, her mentor, was it Dick Little, who called her one of the best men for the job as both reporter and then bureau chief for the Chicago Tribune. So, what made her special as a journalist?
Well, I think what made her special as a journalist was she had such curiosity, for one thing, and she knew people at all levels of Berlin society, including the new politicians of the Weimar Republic. These are people who have never run a government before and are now running a government, and she knows them well. Obviously, the language skills help, but she doesn't take no for an answer. She finds back doors into stories when she can't get an interview through the front door. She just finds another way to go. One of my favorite examples of that was at the death of the first president of the Weimar Republic. He was hospitalized with what he had thought was the flu, and it turned out to be appendicitis. And the government closed off the hospital and said he was doing just fine. And she had bronchitis, so she got herself admitted to the same hospital and then convinced a doctor to help her get information. So she reported on his death from inside the hospital at a time when the press office for the Weimar government was still saying there was no need to worry.
Okay.
That type of creativity, tenacity, you can't teach that.
No, you can't. And then, so how did she get the nickname Dragon Lady from Chicago?
Hermann Goering, who was Hitler's right-hand man, actually gave her that nickname. And it happened because there was a period when the Nazis were trying to trap American journalists into running stories that would make them look like they were spies, with the idea that if they could entrap one, they could have a big show trial and the rest of them would be cowed and would follow Nazi instructions more. So one day, a package got delivered to the apartment that she shared with her mother. Her mother called her to let her know it was there. She was afraid that it was a trap, so she hurried home. Sure enough, it was what looked like drawings for an engine for an airplane. And she figured the Gestapo could not be far behind. She shredded them. She waited until they burned down to ash. And sure enough, on the way back to the office, she ran into a man who she was sure was involved in this plot to entrap journalists and what she called two shady figures who were with him. She stepped right in their path and said, "Don't even bother. I destroyed everything. There's nothing there to find." But she didn't want to leave it at that. She decided it was time to call Hermann Goering on this ongoing attempt to entrap Americans. So a few days later, she is at a luncheon that the Foreign Press Club was giving to honor Goering. And so there, in front of the entire Foreign Press Corps, she calls him on it and tells him, "You just got to stop this. We're none of us stupid enough to run these stories. Just, it's not going to happen." And he lost it and said, "You're never going to learn to show proper respect for authority, Schultz. Must be because you come from that crime-ridden city of Chicago." But after that, he and his staff always called her the Dragon from Chicago. And yes, she took that name with pride.
That's pretty amazing because she reported she was in Berlin so long as the Nazi Party, started their rise and then
Right.
once got into the government and then Hitler's campaign of extermination and all. So she was able to deal with Nazi officials and push back on their attempts to keep her and other journalists from telling the truth about what was going on in the country and obviously exporting that information internationally. How was she able to do that without getting arrested?
Right. And some of it is she's so visible. I mean, that really is part of it. And why she succeeded when some others, partly she walks a very careful line. She doesn't want to get thrown out because she wants to be able to continue reporting this story. And there were other reporters who got thrown out or were made so uncomfortable that they voluntarily threw themselves out. So there's partially this self-censorship isn't quite the right word because she certainly reports on all the big stories and she certainly points out in those stories that the Nazis are manipulating the truth, that they are doing horrible things, but there's always this very careful line. And a consciousness that she has to walk carefully or she's going to get thrown out. But one of her favorite ways of doing it was she put the hot story in the middle of two parts of a less hot story, sort of the idea that people don't always read all the way down so that the German censors were less apt to find the hot story in the middle.
The opposite of the inverted pyramid. You don't
That's right.
all the information at the top, you put it in inside.
That's right. You hide it in the middle, sure, that only the people who really read all the way down are going to see it. Now, the disadvantage to that, of course, is that people in the United States also don't see the hot story sometimes. And that also occurred because the Tribune would sometimes place her stories in less than prime locations, because she and Colonel McCormick disagreed on just about everything. A major piece on Nazi politics ends up on the entertainment page next to a story about Mae West.
Wow.
I mean, she got plenty of front page coverage, but some of her hottest stuff ends up deeper in the paper.
And just so people know, Colonel McCormick was who?
Oh, I'm sorry. He was the owner and publisher of the Chicago Tribune.
Right. Okay.
I like to call him Chicago's isolationist in chief.
It's amazing that she's able to deal with him as well as the
Yep.
Nazis.
Yep.
She in 19, was it 38, 39, she got interested in Hitler and his astrology
Yes.
and reported
Yes.
on that. Why?
People knew that Hitler was fascinated by astrology, and she was trying to find out just how big a role it played in his decision making, because there was some reason to believe that, in fact, it played a large role. So she was pursuing the story for that reason. But in the course of pursuing the astrology story, because she's meeting with some of his favorite astrologers, she meets with a palm reader he uses, that's where she gets the first clue about what was going to be her biggest scoop, which was the non-aggression pact between Germany and Russia, where it gets signed in August of 1939. She first talks about the possibility of it in May of that year. That's the last piece that Hitler needed in place before he was comfortable invading Poland. So her scoop there, it's the biggest one of her career. And that actually comes through the astrology leads.
That's amazing. So let me ask you a little bit about your research for this book. Given the fact that she was not just multilingual, but she was multi-traveled, she traveled all over Europe. So did your research take you there? Did you have to kind of follow the breadcrumbs through the various countries she lived in?
I ended up signing the contract for this book just as COVID started, which meant in practical terms, I was not able to follow the breadcrumbs through Europe. And by the time I was able to, I was deep enough into the work that it didn't feel like the right choice for a lot of reasons. I mean, partially just from time, but also, everywhere she ever lived has been destroyed, including her two homes in the United States don't exist, but every place she lived or worked in Berlin was rubble by the end of the war. So that if you go to Berlin now, you're not walking where she walked anyway. There was one British reporter who, when he arrived in Berlin at the end of the war, who basically said, "What happened to London is nothing compared to this. This is just total destruction of the center of the city." So instead, I ended up having to walk in her footsteps virtually. A lot of maps, a lot of photographs. It's not the same, but sometimes you do the best you can.
Exactly. So then the pictures that you found in this house or were found in the house and then you were available or made aware of it, how did they survive? Because that was not the house that she grew up in, right?
It was the house she grew up in. And the reason the architectural salvage guy was there was he had paid for the right to take anything out that he thought was sellable before they took the house down.
Okay.
So it's
Oh.
literally the destruction of the last house that led me to tell this story.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. Did she leave personal papers or journals?
She
Are
did.
there archives that are accessible to
There
you?
are. In fact, I was incredibly lucky about the amount of material. Most of her papers are at the Wisconsin Historical Society in Madison. And that's, I mean, there are just boxes and boxes of letters, draft articles, things that aren't quite diaries. She kept little, really almost calendars, but lots of detailed notes about what was happening and going on these little calendars that are, the size of a 3x5 card, but lots and lots of details, lots of photos there. There's also the McCormick and Tribune archives that are at Northwestern here in Chicago, where you've got her correspondence with the Tribune, both with Colonel McCormick, but also with her various editors over the years, writing about stories. And in some cases, correspondence between people at the Tribune talking about Sigrid as well, assessments of how she's doing as a reporter, discussions of whether to give her a raise, that kind of material is there. One thing that's actually fascinating there is one of the things that Robert McCormick required his bureau chiefs to do was to send him weekly reports of what was happening in the city they were in that were not necessarily for publication. So those letters give a much more open discussion of what's happening in Germany and what she thinks about what's happening in Germany than appears in the paper itself. And then the other archive is, in fact, the Tribune itself. I literally read every bylined article that she wrote from 1919 through the 1960s. In chronological order, and get this sweeping sense of her career, but also of the history of Germany.
Wow. Now, what about her personal life? How were you able to get information about that? Did you interview family members, any colleagues who were still alive?
None of her colleagues were alive, and she was an only child. I think she had some surviving cousins still in Norway, but I was not able to interview any of them. What I have for her personal life are letters, lots and lots of letters, both to the people that she's friends with. She had three great loves, and I've got letters to and from two of them. And I must say, she wrote things to her mother that I would never write to my mother. So you also get a very personal, you make a very clear account of her personal life from letters to her mother when they are separated, when she's in Berlin and her mother is back in the United States.
That is really amazing. It really is. Other than the Tribune, who decided or who took it upon themselves to really make sure that these papers, her papers, were preserved?
The Wisconsin Historical Society actually wrote and asked if they could have her papers. They were attempting to create a center focusing on Midwestern related journalists. So a number of journalists' papers are there, particularly ones who were in Germany at the time. So it's really just the luck that someone decided to ask.
Did she decide to save and preserve her papers?
She was
Yes.
an absolute pack
That
rat.
makes sense.
Her archives include Christmas cards that she received. They include her astrological charts on occasion. I mean, she just kept everything that she could possibly keep.
Wow. So then, how did you sift through all of that information?
Okay. I'm a big believer in spreadsheets. And again, this is during COVID, so the fact that they opened up that archive at all was amazing. They opened it up in July, August, September of 2020 for really short periods of time, for 6 hours a day, 3 days a week. So my husband drove me back and forth from Chicago to Madison, and I couldn't slowly type notes. I bought a portable scanner and I just sat and scanned document after document after document. And then once I got back in Chicago with them, I began to build a spreadsheet that said this document, and I made sure everything was labeled so I knew which box, which folder. Just spreadsheets that gave me an index to every document.
And then what was your writing process? Did you wait until you had all the materials together, or did you write as you were researching?
A little bit of both. As I was building the index and looking at things, I started making a master document where I just dumped anything that I thought I might want to use in chronological order. I had a sense of where my chapter breaks might be, those that didn't turn out to be entirely accurate. So, I created a 300-page master document that had all the stuff I knew, and then started to take that and shape it and turn it into story. And then I found the holes, and then I went back and found the answers I didn't have, or found that I wasn't going to be able to get the answer, and then had to say, we don't know this.
And because Sigrid was not, she's not a well-known figure.
Right.
So how were you able, and did you have any issues with getting your book proposal accepted by a publisher so that, it could then become the book that it is?
I luckily didn't. And I think the reason I didn't was that Beacon Press, which is the publisher for it, had published my last book so that they were prepared to read the proposal with an open heart. And they recognized that her story was, in some ways, a very modern story about the importance of the press, about glass ceilings, about conspiracy theories, and so they accepted it pretty quickly.
All right. Well, do you have any recommendations for anyone who is trying to, say, follow in your footsteps and write about a lesser-known figure?
One is to be sure you keep your hands on the chronology so that you place her in time. It's really easy with someone like that to lose track of how it fits. Certainly, she often would fableize a little bit, so you have to pick it apart and see whether the dates she's saying actually make sense. But yeah, the most important thing for writing it, as opposed to getting someone interested in a lesser known figure, is to be sure you keep track of the big events that are going on around her and how she responds to them and fits in with them.
And I think you did a great job of contextualizing her life.
I'm glad to hear that because I was absolutely determined to get that piece right.
That was historian and author Pamela Toler speaking with me about her latest book, The Dragon from Chicago: The Untold Story of an American Reporter in Nazi Germany. It was published by Beacon Press in August 2024, and we recorded this interview via Zoom this fall. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Alani Hodge created our theme music, and until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a fantastic day.